we've been doing right now for some time. I've been spending 1 week per word, which is really going to keep us here until we're all really old. Because the list that we're working with now was something that Swami Kriyananda wrote out as the characteristics of a spiritual master. And it's not, we're not looking at them so much to evaluate others, as I've been using them as the way of defining what it is to be very advanced spiritually, and then how these characteristics we can aspire to have them in our own lives. That's the angle from which I've been taking, and I may try to just speed through and do a couple of words tonight, but we'll see. Last week we ended up, however, in a long discussion about karma and surrender versus self-effort. That was your question, Brenda. That's what got us sort of launched in that. And then during the week, somebody sent me some email questions. They said, quote, "I'm not very good on a microphone, so maybe I could answer." But the person who asked isn't here tonight, but she said, go ahead and answer them, and she'll just listen to the recording. So we're going to stay on that same subject for a while, which will slow us down even more. Not that anybody is streaking to a goal here. Last week I ended up, and I don't even remember why I started talking about it, but I was talking about this woman that I see when I go to the YMCA, who has, now I found the correct word for it, and is developmentally delayed. I use the very old-fashioned word and say that she was mentally retarded, which you're not supposed to say. But I realize that developmentally delayed is a euphemism that does not even describe the condition, because they're delayed until this incarnation is over, and that's not really what people mean to say, because if the brain, I mean, a person, I don't know what word to use, who doesn't fully develop in their brain doesn't work, and so there's no delay in it. It's just not going to happen. And as I was saying last week, there's nothing wrong with the soul or the intelligence even. It's just that the brain doesn't function, so the energy can't get through in a proper manner. But the comment I made was the interesting observation I made from just listening to the tone of voice of this woman, that she had what sounded to me, and I've heard her for many years now, what I called a state of thwarted entitlement. She has a tone in her voice of, nobody really appreciates me, nobody really understands who I am, nobody really gives me my due, which would be a very easy attitude for a person in her physical condition, and as a result, her mental condition, to get into. Because there would be, even karmically speaking, when you think about this, a sense of, I'm perfectly fine in here, but I can't quite get out what I am, and so nobody really honors me for who I am. I mean, that's a common feeling that we all have a lot of times anyway, even when we have the full ability to express and communicate. So you could see how, if that was thwarted by a physical wall, how frustrated you could feel. The question I raised was, which I couldn't answer, was, did the person end up in that thwarted body, that non-functioning brain, limited functioning brain, because they had that attitude, or did they develop the attitude because they ended up in that body? Because it would be a very, it could be a very appropriate karma for someone who went around wondering all the time why people didn't appreciate them, or who misused a position to sort of be caught in that kind of karma, until you would have the humility and the sense of inner freedom sufficient to just relax into it and let it be okay. You know, karma is very subtle. There was a person in our community for a period of time who had tremendous creativity and intelligence, but had the karma for no one to ever listen to them, ever. They just never got their way, ever. And Swami just said at one point that, you know, that person had misused a position of power at one point. And so the karma for that was, you know, subtle. It was like to know that you have something to give, but nobody's going to give you any power at all. And it was just like, it was so fascinating to watch, because it just, they never really could get any traction anywhere. Even when they should have been listened to, they were not listened to, because they were having to work through that wrong use of energy. Swami talks in another place about being in Howrah Station in Calcutta, where there was a whole group of beggar children, and they all sort of looked like beggar children, except one of them, he said, who had a very aristocratic bearing and was just sort of standing there with her hand out. But her whole demeanor was how did I ever end up here? And he could just feel that this had been a very wealthy woman who'd been very selfish with her money, and so literally had been born a beggar because she had not understood money properly, but she still had that somewhere deeper than conscious memory of, this is not really my position, why am I here? You know, very odd and funny things can happen. Well, anyway, in all of that, these questions were asked. And is it possible that the souls of people who do not have a fully working brain are also here to help those people around them with their karma? Well, the thing about karma is, and is it even possible that a great soul would put themselves in such a position for this purpose? Swamiji once raised the issue sometimes that great souls do. I don't know if he actually talked about a person whose brain didn't work, but who can appear to be idiots almost, because they just don't want to be bothered. They don't want to be bothered by anybody else asking anything of them, so they can just be left alone to have their own inner life without having to have any kind of functioning life in the world. So yes, it's possible those things could happen. You could see someone who could be born into wealth and comfort, but without a fully functioning capacity, who could just be taken care of their whole lives, and they could just have their inner state of consciousness. Then the only trouble with saying that is sometimes people then get very sentimental about individuals in this position and project upon all of them a kind of saintliness. At the same time, sometimes when you're not troubled by the same things everyone else is troubled by, you see things more clearly. There's a very good book called Waiting for Adam, which is written by a woman who was a Harvard PhD student. She and her husband, and she got pregnant. And all her friends just assumed she would terminate the pregnancy because it was at a very inconvenient time. It was going to interfere with their exams. But she started out by refusing to terminate it, you know, in other words, choosing to have the baby rather than choosing her career. This was the beginning of the end of her life at Harvard, which is also what this book is about. And then they discovered that the child had Down syndrome. And so all of her highly intellectual friends just assumed she would terminate the pregnancy, and she didn't. And so then she ended up, they left academia and went to a whole other life after that. The child was the impetus for that. So she has this little boy named Adam who has Down syndrome, and then she subsequently has two children with fully functioning intelligence. And then she just talks about who's the smarter and who's the dumber one here. She talked about a particular Christmas when one family used to always give her son presents that involved batteries, you know, toys that involved lots of batteries. So they'd wrap the toy and then they would also give him a box of batteries to go with it every year. And that same Christmas, both of the little girls had asked for some special Barbie something or another. And so the son unwraps his batteries. He doesn't even unwrap the toy. He just unwraps his batteries. He's so excited to have batteries. He runs all through the house and he changes the batteries in every single device in the whole house because he's just so thrilled because he has all these new batteries, having such a good time. Meanwhile, his two sisters unwrap the present, the very present they asked for, but somehow or another they didn't get the right color. And so instead of enjoying what they had, they're both having absolute hysterical meltdowns over their terrible present while their brother is running around changing the batteries and all the, you know. And so the mother asks the obvious question, like, who is the retarded child here and who is the wise child? You know, just, you can't go too far with that. But, and the other one that she said about this boy, which was so fun, she says a lot about, you know, how the public school systems work and how many times she had to have this child tested over and over and over again. And they would always test the child to see what the limit of his understanding was. And of course, she knew a lot about what his understanding was. For example, every day they would go together to put the girls onto a school bus. And, you know, he knew the buses. He even knew the numbers of the buses. And he knew what a bus was. And he could say the word and so on. So she was conscious of this. But they would give him this test, and they would just keep testing him. It was a whole week of testing, and they would test him up to the point where he'd reached the limit of his knowledge. And as soon as he couldn't answer the questions anymore, then he would get to go out and play, and he would get a soda. So this kid pretty soon figured out that, well, the sooner I fail, the sooner I get to go outside and get a soda. And the poor mother, knowing fully well what her son was doing, because the word was bus, you know, and he was just missing it completely, looking so satisfied with himself, he'd figured out, you know, how to get to the prize sooner. And the frustration of the mother was she couldn't convince the teacher that he was smart enough to figure that out, you know. But of course she knew full well he was. But from his point of view, what is the point of all this fussing and straining? So you don't really know. You know, it's very hard to read. It's very hard to tell what's going on. I mean, that's a very dramatic example. So yes, you know, somebody could do it either because they themselves wanted a time out. They wanted a lifetime in which they didn't have to have any responsibilities. They just wanted to relax. Of course, the family into which you're born, the whole family has karma. I talked to a woman recently. There were 5 children in the family. 4 of them were mentally deficient. She was the only normal child in the whole family. Can you imagine? It was quite a scene. But imagine the karma of the parents. It's just everybody's interrelated karma in such a situation, because everything is woven. And, you know, many people learn very serious and deep spiritual lessons from not having things come out the way you want them to come out. So the best way to look at everything is that we're all doing this together. You know, you could be paying back karma. Maybe you refused to take care of this child when you should have. So now you get it back in spades, because you never really get away with anything. Everything catches up with you sooner or later. Many different possible explanations to that. So this lady also asked me, and this is an unrelated question, but there's a story that's told about Master. Just after World War II, when a violent windstorm came up very suddenly in Los Angeles, some of you know this story, and Yogananda took one of his disciples outside and told her to take off her shoe and wrap, you know, bang her shoe on the porch and say this certain mantra. And Master said that wind was an effect of some of the bad karma of the war, that had just somehow taken the form of this wind, and then by that mantra and by the power he put into that, the wind suddenly died down. And even there was a news story about this sudden freak wind that had come up and then just died down just as mysteriously. And Master had been engaged in that. Now, you know, the question is all weather an expression, you know, of some kind of karmic condition? Being tonight, you know, Brahmani at least is wrapped up in a shawl, and last week it was so hot I wouldn't even wear my sandals standing up here. We just all thought we'd die from the heat. It's just, even right now, we're having very odd weather patterns. And, you know, it's affecting crops, and we're having floods, and it's and there's cyclones and just tornadoes, things that are not pleasant. What to speak of tsunamis and earthquakes. And Master says emphatically that the human magnetism, dissonant human magnetism on the scale that we're seeing now affects everything, including the weather. That thoughts are very powerful and they create magnetic fields, and as those magnetic fields accumulate, everything is magnetism and begins to relate to it. I should have brought it. I'll try to remember it for next week. He wrote this little paragraph just talking, he wrote this in the 40s, I think, talking about how Italy's invasion of, was it Ethiopia that they invaded? And then just how that and the, what he did was he tied together all these world events, the influenza epidemic here, the invasion of this country here, the violence over here, the hurricane here, the drought in this part, and he just tied them all together as just being one force of energy that was just, you know, pushing and pulling and making everything happen in very strange ways. Extremely, on one hand, you don't know what to think of it, but the other side of it, you see, is by right action and by right consciousness, you also begin to create vibrations that will make everything different. When someone came to Swamiji once and wanted him, Swami Kriyananda, and wanted him to put the authority of Ananda behind a certain ecological movement, Swami's response was, if everyone in the world lived as we do at Ananda, he said, we wouldn't have any of these problems. And he didn't mean that we're so good at recycling or anything like that at all. What he meant was that if the whole world meditated and tried to live in tune with higher consciousness, with the kind of selfless dedication that characterizes the Ananda communities, then that we wouldn't have all this dissonance. And if we didn't have all this dissonance, we wouldn't have all these other issues either. Just one thing leads to another, which is to say we're very, very powerful, much more powerful than we realize. And there's no harm in doing these physically related things also. It's the appropriate response. But what really will affect things is attunement with divine consciousness. And, you know, I consider the work that we do to be intensely political activism, because it will have more effect, I think, in the end than anything else. Yes, Adam.
I was just thinking about the example where someone asked Yogananda if, you know, there were a plane crash and everyone on the plane died. Does that mean that everyone on the plane necessarily had bad karma? And the answer was something along the lines of, well, certain people may just not necessarily have had good enough karma to avert that disaster. Am I saying that right?
You're close.
And okay. And I guess the question that I'm asking from that is, where's the line between collective karma, or I guess put another way, is it possible to be caught up in collective karma that's not necessarily your own?
Oh, absolutely. The actual statement of Masters was, it's not necessarily that it's a very strange statement. It's not necessarily that everyone had the karma to die. Some of them may not have had the karma to die, but they didn't have sufficient karma to live to extricate them from the force field that was going down. It happened in our community. There was a plane from Chicago. This was many years ago, and the plane went down and everybody died. And the mother of one of our residents had had a ticket on that plane. And just a couple of days before the flight, the daughter just felt and called her mom and said, Mom, this just isn't a good time to come. And the mother said, I have my ticket. I'm planning to come. I know, Mom, but it's just not a good time. Just postpone your trip. Just for no reason. She just felt she didn't really want to see her mother. So her mother canceled her trip. She would have been on that plane otherwise. I mean, you hear that all the time. We got caught in traffic and we couldn't get there. I suddenly became violently ill and, you know, the taxi left without me. Just, I started coughing and I had to go. I got a call. You know, something happens and you're extricated from it. You have, you know, you're sort of being pulled into it, but your personal magnetism is greater than that force. You can think of it just like a riptide. You know, you can be a strong enough swimmer that you won't end up in that riptide, or you can just get in it and it'll just carry you out to sea. So for this reason, Master says, you know, we should always be acting with conscious awareness and not allow ourselves to just become subconscious in our own lives. Many people are quite subconscious in their own lives. They just go along. They don't know what they really think. They allow, you know, undharmic or unkind things to happen just around them, and they don't stand up from it. Don't really have a conscious idea of where I'm going and what I'm doing with my life. It doesn't mean you have to have worldly ambitions, but you have to have a commitment to your own inner consciousness. Otherwise, yeah, you'll just get sucked into things. And even as we talk, as we have often talked now about what may be in fact difficult times coming to this country, the absolute best way to make yourself ready is to build your inner life. Because if you build your inner life, you'll be right where you need to be. And I've heard recently, Swami was talking about this, some spiritual group right in the city where one of the atom bombs was dropped, and that group and the building they were in was not hurt. And it was just, they were living on a different vibration, and so they just had sufficient karma of another kind that what devastated everyone else in an objective physical way did not hurt them. I think, isn't there a church in Hawaii where the lava went and divided in front of it? And just, you know, instead of running right through it, it just went right around it. Yeah, I mean, these things are quite common. They happen quite commonly, so. Okay. And then this last question, I mean, this class could be about karma forever, but so after this we'll stop. She raised the question, which is also a very common misunderstanding. Which is, if everything's your karma, people get in their minds, that means they should become passive in front of the events of their lives. you know, what if something happens that, you know, that I'm being mistreated? Or, you know, there's a divorce or there's some kind of a custody battle over my children. Do I take everything just, you know, as God's will? No, not at all. You take everything as an appropriate challenge for your consciousness. But what, how you respond to that consciousness entirely depends on where you are in relationship to center. And that's the picture that we have to always understand. Everything about our life is trying to make us stronger and stronger at our center. And if we allow people to mistreat us and overrun us from weakness and fear and laziness or lack of clarity of mind of what to do, that's not standing in your center. It's not about being passive and it's not about being nice. It's knowing what's true and having the courage to stand up for it. You look at the lives of the masters, they were not pushovers. They were very, very strong in what they stood for. Swami Kriyananda, when the movie about St. Francis came out many years ago, Brother, Sun, Sister, Moon, by now it's ancient history, but many people liked that movie. Swami was appalled by it because it made St. Francis seem like he was stoned and just completely daft and just wandering around accidentally becoming a saint. You know, there was no hint of willpower, or dynamic determination, or standing up for the truth as he understood it. It was all just this limp nothingness, just kind of dancing through the fields like this. You know, that's not working out your karma. That's just being blown by the winds of time. You know, when things come to you, you have to honestly and courageously and deeply think, what shall I do here? I was reading just recently a little bit about the life of Joan of Arc. I mean, you look at the lives of the saints. Her voice has called her to be a soldier for France. Ultimately, she was betrayed by the very people she helped and burned at the stake. But that was a very triumphant life, even though it didn't appear to be. Because God called her, she responded, and she never wavered, no matter what came. And if we have a duty in life, a responsibility, a destiny, we have to hold to that, you know, even if death itself tries to take it away from us. So power is one of the aspects of the divine. And when appropriate, in harmony with other aspects of the divine, it's exactly the way to behave. And in fact, it's better, you know, to be powerful and be a little wrong than it is to be too weak. Because if you have power, even if you're misusing it, it can always be directed in the right direction. But if you don't have any power, even as Swamiji said, some people appear to be pious, but they're simply too low energy to sin. And it doesn't mean that they're good. It just means they haven't risen to the level yet of having the energy to pursue their desires. And you're not free. You haven't even started. You know? There's a story, and I presume it's true, about Vivekananda when some very weak-willed man asked him how he could realize God. And Vivekananda told him to learn to be a good liar and an excellent thief. And then once he mastered those, they could talk about how he could realize God. The answer, the meaning behind that being that he saw that this man really did not have a desire for God. He had very nefarious desires, but he didn't even have the energy yet to follow those. So first he had to follow what was really in him, and then he could work his way through it and transcend them. So we have to ask ourselves. I was listening to this little recording about a devotee of Durgamata, who was one of Yogananda's most advanced woman disciples. And she said, let me think exactly how she said it. Do your best and then relax and be natural. That's how she put it. It's a very interesting statement. Just do your best and then just relax and be natural. Because that, and I mean, it was a very succinct articulation of something I've often thought of. You know, just, you're not going to be better than you are. Just stop trying. Just do as well as you can and then just let whatever it is be. Master Swami talks about sometimes people, a couple of devotees would, usually people were very respectful around Master and behaved in a refined way, but every so often there would be somebody come who had no idea of the protocol. slapping Master on the back, putting their arm around him. He said sometimes even telling off-color jokes or coming around Master when they were a little drunk. And oftentimes Master was just so supportive and so loving because this was just who this person was. And he could feel the sincerity underneath it, and then they were just being themselves, and this is who they were. I mean, he reprimanded some of his monks for, as he'd said, talking about things that monks should not be talking about, because for them it was not appropriate. But you do your best, and then you act, then you just behave in a natural manner, and everything will progress more effectively after that. Okay, well, those were a lot of questions. Is there anything else about any of that before we go back to our text here? Okay, so let's see. Last week we talked a lot about calmness. The list here has said intuition, wisdom, even-mindedness, freedom from moods, fearlessness, sincerity, calmness that is natural without effort, and then the one that follows that is self-control. And then he gives a couple of examples of the ability to still the body without any effort, the ability to still the breath without holding the breath. Just starting with self-control, I was just talking about do your best and then be natural. And then the next word after that is self-control. You know, what we really have to understand about the spiritual path, and when we're looking at a master, which is what Swamiji is describing in these lessons, he's describing the characteristics of Paramahansa Yogananda as he knew them to be. That self-control is not the idea of imposing upon yourself this rigid self-control. Sometimes you see that in ashrams and religious works. And you see it, it's an unfortunate consequence sometimes of celibate orders, that there's a kind of tension that develops because of the strain of that one commitment that can, in some cases, dominate all other commitments. And as Swamiji said, sometimes the difficulty with celibacy is that instead of becoming lighter and lighter, you said you become tighter and tighter, which is really not a very helpful state of mind if you have a choice in the matter. If God gives you no choice, then you live as you have to live. But nonetheless, one wants to realize that you don't want to allow your discipline to make you tense. But the kind of self-control that... but also what I was saying is that by the time a master is at his state of self-realization, it's because he's lived through all of these states. You know, a master is the fulfilled destiny of every incarnated being. He's literally been where we are, and we're all working together to come to this point. So when the master has this self-control, it's this constant, what you would call, he's always aware. He never loses track of who he is, of what he's doing, of where he should be. He never allows forces other than his attunement with God to move his energy in any direction. And working for that kind of self-control is just, it's just something that we just have to put out energy to every single day. You know, to be aware, to be centered, to not allow our desires, our emotions, our habits, our aversions, our likes and dislikes, to compel us in any direction at all. This is why I often say about the spiritual life, it's a state of freedom from compulsion. Just think how many things we act on compulsively. But the spiritual path is complete freedom from compulsion. We have disidentified even with our own bodies. You know, even with the sense of hunger and cold, what to speak of sexual imperatives or others like that, to just be in a state where whether I eat or not, what difference does it make to me? Whether I put on a sweater or not, what difference does it make to me? Master would often, once when he was in a very hot train without any air conditioning, he just imagined, you know, cold, and when you touched his skin, it was just icy cold. He was so able to master even his physical functions that he could just move himself outside of conditions that everybody else would be bound by. And Master suggests to us, and it's a good practice, that we don't always make ourselves comfortable. And in fact, as I was commenting that to a different group, that this is a hard thing to say because people get very reactive to this, but Master also said, raise your children to be a little tough. He said, don't always coddle them. He actually said, don't always feed them when they're hungry. Don't always put a sweater on them when they're cold. And in other words, don't make them feel that every time some little, you know, little wave of I want things to be different happens, that you rush over to make sure that the universe is just as they want it to be. Now, obviously, that has to be done with the right attitude and the right understanding. But it doesn't hurt children to develop a little bit of endurance. It makes them strong. I was so amused the other day. I saw Craig Kellogg and little Mateo. Craig is one of our school teachers, and he's a big man. He plays ice hockey and other sports. He has a big, strong body. And Mateo is just turned 3. And Mateo's a small child. He's a little child with a big head. He's what we call lovingly a watermelon baby. He has a big head. He's a darling child with this great big face. And I came up behind them, and they had been sort of over at the water fountain, and Craig was kneeling down. He was sort of helping Mateo. And as it turned out, apparently on the playing field, on the playground, Mateo had fallen over and hurt himself. And so Craig was cleaning him up, and after he, you know, dusted him off, Craig had Mateo's hand, and Mateo was, you know, just looking up at Craig like this. And Craig looks down, and he says, walk it off, buddy. Just walk it off. And he said, you can do it. Walk it off. Mateo's. And I just thought, you know, thank God for fathers. Because, you know, mothers would be like, oh, darling, are you all right? Do you want me to carry you? Should we go back? I'll buy you a little treat. You know, and Craig's saying, walk it off, buddy, just walk it off. But you could see that, you know, Mateo was responding to that in the right way. I have the willpower, I can do this. I don't have to just collapse, I can keep going, I can walk it off. That's how we should think about ourselves. I mean, you know, I know that's a common, I've since learned a common sports term, never having been in those things, I didn't even know it. But I actually have been saying that to myself sometimes, walk it off, I should just walk it off. You know, you don't have to collapse. Exercise a little bit of self-control. The master is in complete command of his consciousness at all times. You know, just in complete command. And that's why the master's always in a state of bliss. Or if strong action is needed, he can generate strong action. If complete stillness is needed, he has complete stillness. If it's time to be outgoing and to teach and to win people by charm, then he's the most charming person there is. Swamiji said that Yogananda was so remarkable in the fluidity of his consciousness. He could just be the most charming host, and then if it was appropriate with the disciples, he could be absolutely silent. And he tells the story of having to scold one of the nuns very fiercely, and there was one person sitting at one side of the room and the other at the other, and Master was ranting at this one on this side, speaking just shaking the room with his voice, and then he would turn around and he would kind of wink at the other one. Then he would turn around and go like this again. He was in complete control of his consciousness, and he simply did what was needed. I mean, just think how free you are if you just can do what's needed. What's required now is strength, what's required now is sweetness, stillness, action. And so we need to practice. We need to practice not allowing. And you see, this is where the spiritual path really diverges from a lot of pop culture and popular psychological wisdom. And it must be added that there's an appropriate stage for this. You know, if one is, because sometimes I'll get people in classes and I'll just use one example. Maybe they're in Alcoholics Anonymous or Al-Anon specifically, where you grew up in a family that was not functioning properly, and you never really got a proper sense of yourself. And maybe your adult life has been to fight the way to the point to have a self to assert. You know, you can't transcend all of these things until you actually own them. And you can't skip the necessity to be consciously aware of your own reality and to be integrated. But once you are, it's really so much less important. On the spiritual path is not just about the ego getting more and more impressive. It's really just getting so bored with it and just so completely uninterested that once it's basically functioning, then you just want to become master of it. You don't want to just be expressing yourself left and right and knowing how you feel and telling everyone else how you feel. Just forget it. Just be a little more impersonal. And this is the position of a master. He doesn't even have a personality. You know, Swami Master said that. He said, no one dwells. I killed Yogananda long ago. He said, no one dwells in this temple now but God. And the way Swami Kriyananda described himself, he said, I never identify with Swami Kriyananda. I think of him as an event for which I am responsible. I just love that. Think of yourself as like a big reception, a big party that you're putting on, where everything has to be in place, but it doesn't have anything to do with you. And when you have that attitude, it's not so difficult then to keep yourself mastered because you're not compelled. So watch it. And don't be afraid to be a little tough with yourself. No harm. We don't always have to worry about it. Yes?
At that point, you're no longer trying to control the self, but the big self with the big S is in charge.
That's exactly right.
So the self is now the doer as opposed to the one that's being controlled.
That's exactly right. Yeah. That's exactly right. It becomes spontaneous. And it's just you don't, you know, Swamiji, we used to see this ad somewhere, you know, up near Grass Valley. It was an ad for Reno. And it, or maybe it was an ad for Las Vegas. Let yourself go in Las Vegas. And then there were like these pictures of these people who Swamiji said were not so much letting themselves go as falling apart at the seams, is how he described it. And you just had this picture of these people who looked half crazed, you know, just gambling and drinking and, you know, indulging everything they could think of and indulging in. It was just, it's this huge billboard. And it's held up as like, this is the ideal. This is, you know, this is where the most pleasure would come from if you can just fall apart at the seams. But, the, you know, the image of the yogi is completely different than that, just very centered in himself and not at all in that flow. And you can see it's just a whole different way of defining everything. You know, the energization exercises that Master teaches are just a lot about bringing all that energy under control. That's a, that 12-minute set of exercises, if you don't know, it's really worth learning. If you don't practice them, I encourage you to start practicing them because they really give you mastery over the life force. And mastery over the life force is the beginning of everything because then it leads to the ability to still the body without effort and the ability to stop your breath. Now, these are, I mean, I can't do these things, but you can go toward them. You know, you can sit to meditate and not feel that you have to just jump all over the place. And you can calm yourself by calming your breath. But, of course, the master transcends it altogether because he can move in and out of his body. He's not identified with his body, and therefore he's not compelled by it at all. Remember the story about Master where the wishing well fell on his foot and it crushed, you know, the bones of his foot. It was a physical reality. And he said, I'll show you something. And then he put his consciousness to the level. He said, I'll put my consciousness into my body. So he did, and all of a sudden his face was contorted with pain and he couldn't stand on his foot. And he said, and now I'll withdraw my consciousness from my body. And he did that, and then he just walked around as if there was nothing at all wrong. You know, it's just a question of where you put your attention and how you respond. So the master can have his body sit perfectly still because he sends his consciousness everywhere, and then there's not even an impulse to move the body. That story that Master tells, Swami tells about Master, walking along with him, and then sort of stumbling a little bit and explaining to Swamiji, I'm in so many bodies, sometimes I forget which one I'm supposed to move. Can you imagine what that would be like? To be so disidentified with the body that you're in that you don't automatically think whether it's hot, cold, or hungry. Sometimes I have to ask people, Master said, whether I've eaten or not. Because I just don't know. I'm not connected enough to this one. Now, what that sets in front of us is tell us that we can't rest on our laurels yet. We have a ways to go. And the same with breath. Breath, of course, is multiple. It's the calmness of the mind, you know, just to be able to still the mind to such an extent that breath isn't necessary. And again, to transcend identification with the body, you know, that the rejuvenating process of the body can happen automatically without the physical intercession of breath. Master used to do, when he was first in America, and he used to fill those halls with so many people who would come to see him speak. One of the reasons was because he did all these remarkable things. Think about him. Here he is. He's in his mid-20s. It's 1920 in America. The First World War has really just ended. He's the first. Vivekananda came to America. Swami Ramatirtha had come to America, but neither of them stayed more than a brief period of time. And Vivekananda, they had both been some years earlier. Yogananda was the first person to really come and commit himself to America. And nobody knew anything about what he was doing. It's not like now where, transportation and communication just has all the countries mingling with each other. He was, the whole concept of a Hindu yogi, an Indian yogi, was just not even known. He was like a magician. He was just so foreign. And he had his long hair, and he wore his orange robes, and he had his Bengali accent. I mean, when you really imagine it, it's really marvelous. And then to make it even more phenomenal, he did phenomenal things. And that's how he got people's attention. He did healings. He healed people. He did miracle healings in these programs. And then he would just do things. You can just see him do this. He would invite the doctors in the room to come up, and he would have them, you know, the doctor would be checking his pulse. Okay, you know, what's the pulse? And then he would have a different doctor on either side, and he would have a different pulse in either arm. And then he would stop his pulse. He would just stop his heart from beating, but he wouldn't die. And, you know, the doctors would be there verifying. And then he'd start it on one side, you know, and then he'd start it on the other. I mean, what were they supposed to think about things like that? And then he would do feats of strength, lying with his heels on one chair and just his head on the other. And people bounce on his stomach, and he would just be able to hold it up. Or the story that's often told of him leaning against the wall, and he invited the policemen who were guarding the place, like six policemen leaning against him, and without any visible effort, but just with the projection of his energy, he knocked them over backwards. You know, you tell your friends and they come the next night. You know. And then in all of this, he would then start talking about what made him who he was and what they could do with it. But he got their attention. Because otherwise you would think he could say things, but how would you know? So he really had to show them that he had a reality that was... And he had a couple of other people traveling with him who could also do very odd things. I mean, he really put on a good show, which in and of itself is interesting, you know, because we're so staid sometimes. He was not staid at all. He needed to get the attention. But as also Swami tells in his book, he had 5,000 people at a lecture and 5 signed up for the classes. So he was touching a lot of people, but then he gradually honed it down to the handful that he would relate to. But still, he could do all those remarkable things. But then the next quality that is the characteristic of a master, ever ready to help others spiritually. And that really is something that we can emulate more easily. We may not have the ability to go breathless at will, but we can establish ourselves with a generous and a helpful attitude, recognizing that this is the quality of a self-realized person, and we might as well start now, especially to help spiritually. And that doesn't mean that we're always walking around giving people advice. You know, we often think that advice is the way to help people. It isn't necessarily the way to help people, as Swami put it to me when I was really a little bit dense on this point. Asha, people do not always want to know. That was the answer. One of my friends said it to me once. You explain my problems to me clearer than I want to know them, is how she put it. It's very helpful. Who am I helping? Anybody can, as Swamiji once said, Swami Kriyananda got a letter. We were having trouble, I think, at that time with our retreat. It wasn't being managed well, and there were lots of judgments being made that were not the best ones, decisions. And somebody wrote, what I was a secretary at the time, what I thought was a really excellent letter, sort of analyzing what the problems were and, you know, where the shortcomings were and so on. I thought it was a really good letter, and I handed it to Swami with a lot of, like, oh, this is a good letter, you'll like this. Swami read it, and I think partly to make the point to me, he crumbled it up and he threw it on the floor. He said, anybody can tell me what's wrong with something. He said, what I need is people who will say, I will take responsibility and I'll make it right. Oh, ah, yes, that is a great deal of difference, isn't it? So it isn't just a question of being able to give advice or be able to criticize. And that's why it's put this way, ever ready to help people spiritually. And sometimes the way you help people spiritually is just vibrationally. Master used to walk around in the Bowery District of Los Angeles, which was like the Tenderloin here in San Francisco. It was just a place where there were a lot of bars and a lot of people who were subject to the nefarious effects of alcohol. And he wouldn't even talk. He wouldn't even relate to him. He'd just walk up and down, you know, just projecting his uplifting magnetism and just trying to give energy to people and help them come out of what they were caught in. Master had very strong feelings about drinking alcohol. I don't know whose tender button I might be touching here, but I really wanted to say that. In fact, I was just listening to a disciple of Durgamata talking. I mentioned that earlier. Durgamata, if you were in the habit of drinking alcohol, she wouldn't even help you spiritually. I mean, she was pretty rigid about those things. Master gave Kriya to an alcoholic man on more than one occasion, thinking that, well, there, Swami tells the story too of a man who was alcoholic and used to drink whiskey constantly, and he also took Kriya initiation. And his, the way Swami tells the story, he would hold his Kriya beads in one hand and his whiskey in the other. And he would drink a little and then he would do a little Kriya. And then finally one day, he just looked at the Kriya and looked at the alcohol and put it down and never picked it up again. And when somebody said to him, how dare you do this? He said, well, I can't seem to stop my drinking, but at least I can add my Kriya to it. But what I was going to say about alcohol was that Master, this is a very interesting thing Master said. He said you should never even take a drink of alcohol in your life. He said, because you never know what kind of samskaras you have. And if you have that in your past lives, he said, you can awaken it so quickly. He said, you don't want to reawaken that again. I mean, you see people who struggle with that, you can certainly. You know, it's like he doesn't, we tend to take these things casually. And of course, on the other side of it is karma is just karma. You know, do your best and then be natural. But it pulls your consciousness down. And it not only draws you into your subconscious and dulls your finer perceptions, but it also puts you in tune with lower astral forces, and you just don't want to go there. Master says that where many people are inebriated, there's often dark astral entities around, literally trying to get into their bodies when their self-control has been removed by drinking. That's why sometimes, you know, people who drink habitually become very strange. They often are literally influenced or even possessed. I mean, these are, why am I talking about this? I'm talking about Master's efforts to help people, and you don't always help people with words. You don't even always help them by example necessarily. Sometimes you just help them with vibrations. And we should never underestimate the benefit that we can exert on the planet and on individuals in it merely by holding the thought and the consciousness of the divine within ourselves wherever we go. You know, it's all about, this whole world is just energy and magnetic vibrations playing into each other. A master can command. He has greater power than any power in the universe. So master cannot end a person's karmic cycle unless it's God's own timing to do that. But he can walk up and down in the Bowery and people will just begin to wake up a little bit. And they won't even know why they're waking up, but they will start waking up. And so in that way, he's seeking those who are ready. And we should just feel that in our lives at all times. It is an interesting fact, and it's a very small thing, but for all the years, most of the years that I've known Swami Kriyananda, whenever he would go out in public, he would always dress up just a little bit. He was always a little better dressed than almost everyone else around him. I mean, maybe not in Nevada City, but when he would be anywhere else. And I really realized, because he always felt he was representing Master, and he always felt he had just had needed that little bit of extra dignity that he needed as a disciple of Master. He wasn't doing it for himself or to impress anyone. It was just, you could feel it in him. He had a responsibility as Master's disciple to present himself magnetically. And I don't think it's important how we dress. I mean, times have changed, you know, in terms of how casual and informal people are. You look at old movies, and the one thing you notice is just how many clothes everybody wore. The men had on suits and ties and hats, and the women had on, you know, dresses and belts and stockings and shoes and hats and gloves. And, you know, people are just much more relaxed about things. But that inner dignity is part of the way we serve, because we're always keeping just a little bit of awareness of God's presence within, so that we're always ready. And then when God does call on us, we recognize that as our first duty, that we just have no other duty except to be an instrument of God, especially when he wants us to really help others. Because, of course, in that action is our own salvation, because this is the fourth and last stage, as we talk in our Festival of Light, which is this willingness simply to live for the sake of God's work in the world. Let's take a little break, and then we'll go on with this. Okay? Okay, any questions or comments or thoughts about anything? Yes, Tigis, do you want to give her the microphone? Uh-huh.
This question is...
No, hold it up close enough.
Hold it up?
Yeah, so that it can be heard.
You know, like how we were talking about karma?
Say it again.
You know how we were talking about karma?
Uh-huh.
This is my first time with the class, but in general, and I was like, is it better to relax and let it be, or is it better to, well, let me correct my karma, what can I do? And it sounds very, two of them are very conflicting, like what we should do and what.
Okay.
I don't know if my question is understood.
Okay, let me try, see if I was going to try to say it back to what the question is. This is, you have to understand that karma is not like a separate thing. It's not like, you know, I'm gonna go outside and my karma is going to be like sitting in the parking lot or something like that. It's the fact that you are who you are in that body, this age, this time, sitting in this room, that's absolutely everything about our lives is karma, which is to say there's a continuous cause-effect expression going on in this world, or so it appears. Okay, on this level of reality, which is the level that we're all living on, where we perceive the physical world as real, we are incarnated and identified with a physical body, we cannot at will dissolve that identification. You know, Master knows what body he's responsible for, just as I was saying, he moves in and out of it, but we can't dissolve it at will. Absolutely everything about us is the manifested moment of the accumulated actions and events, not only of this incarnation, but of all the incarnations before. On one hand, people consider this to be oppressive and terrible, or annoying, right? But on the other hand, you can look at it the other way, that it's marvelously liberating, because we realize that this is not just a random experience, that we are in a marvelous, continuous flow that's actually going somewhere. We are a river heading to the sea. And along the route to get from our origin point to the sea, we're going to go through hills and dales and valleys and adventures and winters and summers and slim times and big times. But it's all one continuous flow. It's not just, oh my God, what happened right here? It's very explicable when we understand that it started somewhere and it's going somewhere, and it's very consistent in its experience.
And there are guideposts as well.
And there's guideposts, and there's ways that we can kind of ride it. You know, you can think of, I was saying we are the whole river. We are also the leaf riding the river. Now, if you think of it as a tapestry, a woven tapestry, where you see a big picture woven into a tapestry, which can be very complicated. You know, it can be a big forest scene, and there can be two little children playing over here, and then there's a hunter killing a deer over here, and then there's a sunset and a boat out on the ocean. But if you look at it, you know, it's one continuous thread going horizontal, continuous threads going vertical, constantly intersecting, and there's no point where you could cut it off over here, pull the threads out, and have it still show up in this way. And any little section you look at looks complete in itself, but its origin is somewhere else. And so you don't understand how it manifested when you're only drawing a small circle, but if you step back, you see how the whole thing has flowed together, where it's come from and where it's going. And at least speaking for myself, when I really finally got that, it was so much more relaxing, because it was just so much of a bigger rhythm, and that which didn't make any sense for me personally or for the world around me suddenly was quite reasonable. Oh, no wonder I fell in love with this man in the first 1 minute I met him, because look at all the threads that were together before. No wonder when I met this person I had this huge visceral negative reaction. Look at all these things that had happened before. No wonder when I tried to do that, it just crashed and burned. Look at all the things that happened before. So once we are willing to accept that, then it begins to tell us how to respond, which is everything is about really transcending those laws of cause and effect by liberating our consciousness from being defined by all of those things that happen. And it's all about liberating your consciousness, because that's the whole point of the whole story. That's arriving at the sea. And the odd thing about this is that it appears to be happening like this, but from a higher perspective or from a deeper perspective, we realize this is just the surface. I mean, we go deep into the ocean and realize that the waves are just happening on the surface. David and I did scuba diving for a while, we did it for a while. And I remember once, after having been down in the bottom of the ocean, when we came up, it was raining at the top. We had no idea that it was raining below. And I remember coming up and just floating for a while with your goggles, just right here. It was the most amazing, because you could watch all these raindrops just falling. It wasn't a heavy rain. It was just falling on the water and bouncing, but just right here, it wasn't happening at all. It was such an incredible moment. And so the karma is what's going on the surface. And as long as we're deeply identified with the surface of our own being, we're always being swept around by it. When we begin to identify with the deeper level of our own reality, our deeper consciousness with God, with the spirit within, it's not like it doesn't keep happening, but our whole relationship to it is different. So there's two levels of how to respond to karma. One is, what is the appropriate response on the surface of the ocean? And the other is, how can I just experience this from the depths of the ocean and just let it roll over me and not be such an enormous factor in my life? You know, people are like that. Oh, things didn't go right. I just feel so terrible today. You know, just they go through all these huge things. You know, oh, I'm having a terrible hair day. I can't really go out today. I've broken a fingernail. You know, I have a spot on my dress. And it's just like, what are you so upset about? But people do. Or they get upset because somebody doesn't like me and now I can't go on like this. Or I didn't get this promotion that I wanted, or I don't have this money. You know, or it's just like, yes, these things are happening. These are the results of the energy that I set in motion. But let me experience it from the bottom of the sea. And then we don't create as many of those agitated causes, because we've stepped outside of all that tumult, and the causes that we're putting in now are much more the causes of an expanded consciousness instead of just a small one. Now, I don't know if that answered anything you were asking or not, did it? Yeah? Yeah? Well, you know, at the same time, you have to realize, and, you know, not everything is easy. And sometimes we have really hard things to go through. There's no point in saying when you're facing something really tough that it isn't. You know, this could... There was this little girl, Cece was her name. She lived at Ananda Village in, you know, in the 1970s. She was the reason we bought another piece of property because she was so noisy that on 75 acres you could not have a meditation retreat and Cece in the same place because you could hear her everywhere. But she came up to Jyotish's house once. He tells this story, and Jyotish had sort of a fairly high step to get up. She was 3 or something. She came up to it. She couldn't quite climb up, and he hears her outside backing up and saying, "This is going to take my full blast," is how she put it. Then she sort of ran on it and scrambled up. Well, you know, sometimes things happen to us, and they're just going to take our full blast. There's no way around it. You know, we're out of money. We're homeless. Somebody's completely betrayed us, mistreated us, something terrible. We're buried under troubles. You know, you can't just sort of passively say that, I can just sail past this. It's not sincere. Sometimes you have to apply every ounce of your strength to get through the things that happen to you. And some of the things that happen to you are just appalling. They just are. But we have to find a way. And there's just no other... I mean, you can rebel against this. You can protest against it. You can argue against it. You can reason against it as much as you like. But sooner or later, you realize that none of that works. The only thing that actually works is to realize that, like it or not, this is what I'm dealing with. And unless eventually I adopt the attitudes of self-realization in regard to my own life, I will never be happy. And so you just, for a long time in our incarnations or in one lifetime, we are going to be happy by thinking of things this way. I refuse to believe in God. I'm going to be angry at God. I don't think karma is true. It's not my fault. There's nothing I can do about it. They need to fix it. You just say, okay, try it. You know, just try it. See if it works. And people can do it for 100 million lifetimes. You just keep trying it. See if it works. Then it's as simple as that. And then if it works for you, I remember when I was having a really stinky attitude about something, this woman healer was helping me, and I described this whole thing and how, you know, I was like this and like this. And so sweetly she said, "And how is that working for you?" Just like that. And of course it wasn't working for me at all. It was causing me horrible trouble. She said it so sweetly, "And how is that working for you?" And it just made me say, "Not at all. It's just not working for me. It's just making me more miserable." So, but I also was able to answer, how is that working for me? And I was able to see how, oh, by holding on to this attitude, then I get to avoid all these other things. But if I ever actually, you know, relinquish this, then I have to deal with all this. So how is that working for you? How does being mad at God work for you? How does denying God's existence work for you? How does saying that karma isn't real work for you? Okay, if it's working for you, then stick with it. But at some point, it stops working for us. And when it stops working for us, we enter the second stage of the soul's long journey, which is called the quest. And the quest is, wonder what's really going on here. All these scriptures say the same thing. Masters keep insisting on this point of view. I have rejected it up until now, but, And nobody can hurry that point. It has to be an absolute point of... That's where people ask Swamiji, do I need a guru? No, not if you don't think so. You know, just go fine. You don't need a guru. If you don't think you need one, you don't need one. But someday you might. So remember the concept. See what happens then. What were you going to say, Adam? The third stage? Oh, I said the second. I always forget. The first stage is the mission, the innocent mission. I do forget. Okay, any questions or thoughts? Does that help at all? I know. Yes. You get, take the microphone. We're very conscientious with the microphone because we do a recording of this.
Just what you just said just fleshed out I was thinking of Gyanamata and her, when the karma was coming, something was coming and she didn't want it to, and then she just said, what'd she say?
She said she saw something coming that she dreaded, But she, at first she said, you know, Lord, spare me. And then she said, no, change no circumstance of my life, Lord, change me. Because you change the circumstances of your life, you're just, you know, you're literally, the wave goes up, the wave goes down, the wave goes up, the wave goes down. You know, make it all come out right for me is like saying, I want the wave to stay at the top. And when our waves start rising, we get so excited and we imagine that they will always stay at the top. But it's the nature of this world that the waves go up and the waves go down. So even if we get everything that we want, sooner or later we won't have it anymore. Time passes, we die. We have that beautiful home and then we get old. We have darling children and then they grow up. We have splendid husbands and relatives and, you know, then they betray us because they have other things they want to do besides just please us. I mean, the stories go on and on and on. Everybody has one. And after a while, you recognize this is not just an exception. This is the pattern. And our first reaction is, this is such a stinky world. We just get really mad. Well, how's that working for you? You know? And then you change. Yeah.
But it's scary.
Oh, it's frightening. It scares me.
I mean, to think of her, I've always seen her just standing there and this thing's coming.
No,
it takes tremendous courage.
Well, that's what we've been talking about. And courage is practically the first quality a devotee needs. You have to have the courage. You have to have the courage to give up the dream world. And that's not easy. You know, it's just not easy. There's no way around it. We just really want it to be different. I'm much more sympathetic than I'm seeming here. It's very hard. But the only thing that makes it not hard is the alternative is worse. Because if we refuse to really understand how the world is made and how it really works, we just doom ourselves to just repeating and repeating and repeating and repeating, and pretty soon the anguishing monotony and the sheer anguish of it is worse than the effort required to perceive these deeper principles and higher realities. And until then, you just, as I've said to you and I've said to others, you just have to be sincere. And the way you're supposed to respond is, you're supposed to respond with courage, with appropriateness, with open-heartedness, and with deeper and deeper devotion to God. It's a hard lesson. This path is not for everyone. It just isn't. I mean, you know, how many people are there in this room? It just isn't. A lot of people it's just not for them. Yeah. Swamiji once, in that song, Go On Alone, he had a verse in there, let them despise you, go on alone. He said, Swami, that's just such a harsh word. But he looked at me so seriously. He said, oh, but they will, just like that. He took the word out eventually because it just didn't sing very well. But, you know, just this, you have to be prepared, and it's okay because that's where you're going. Very, very tough. Not a very cheerful ending. Where can we go from there that's more fun? Is there any other questions or thoughts? But, you know, the funny thing about it is it's not depressing. I mean, having no answers is really depressing. That's really depressing. Feeling like you're just a victim of life, that is really depressing. Recognizing that there is a key to awakening, that's extremely joy-producing. But you have to overcome your doubts before you can do that. Yeah.
To look back when it's finally gone. Well,
yeah,
to look back is a happy ending.
Well, you know, the key to all of this and the experience that you build on is whenever you face courageously difficult circumstances and master them, your sense of satisfaction is so deep, and your growing sense of confidence that you can face things is so liberating, then you ask yourself, is there any limit to that? You see? And also we realize that the more awareness we have, the more freedom we have. When we have no idea why we do things and why we feel this way and what hidden causes there are, and then by psychological or spiritual means we become more and more aware of what our reality is, the more aware we become, the more power and freedom we have. When difficult things come to us and we think we can't handle them and we face into them and we prove to ourselves that indeed I can, then you have that to build on. And it makes you so much stronger. Is there any limit to that? Is there any limit to the freedom that will come from ever greater awareness? Is there any limit to the power that will come from facing and overcoming challenges? And even if we don't want to go there, if we're honest, we'll look back and realize that that's the greater, our greatest source of happiness is the strength and understanding we build, not the comfort of never having to do that. And that is something that Swamiji put it this way. He said, we define things as painful, not realizing sometimes that pain is the fastest route to freedom. And if pain is the fastest route to freedom, is it really painful? It's just the road we have to walk. We have to get across the desert to get where we're going. But we're going to get where we're going if we go across that desert. So even if the desert is unpleasant, is it really unpleasant? Because it's what we have to go through to get there. And we'll never get there till we go through it. So it's a very interesting. We define happiness as pleasure. And pleasure is just ease and lack of stress. But that's not really happiness, that's just pleasure. Because we don't necessarily have freedom. And freedom is everything. It's a bit complicated, but that's the story. And that's as far as I can go with it tonight, unless there's other comments or thoughts.
A saint wouldn't change anything.
Pardon me? A saint wouldn't change anything. You see, there's a certain level of faith that comes in, because every master and saint who's lived through what we've lived through never feels that they've been mistreated and never feels that it's a bad deal and never feels that it wasn't worth it. And instead they say to us, you have no idea. It's so joyful. It's so joyful. Come my way. You have no idea. So much joy, so much joy. And everybody who goes with them agrees. So at a certain point, we also have to have the humility to listen. To just think, you know, to sense when truth is being told to us and have the courage to embrace it. This is all very subtle. Why do we have to pay with our bodies? No, it doesn't necessarily. There's psychological karma, there's physical karma, there's all kinds of karma. The body is, you're in the body, and things happen to the body because it's part of this plane. But, you know, karma happens on all levels, including physical. But many people just have mental karma, you know. No, your mind is, your mind and your awareness. Because we're identified with our body, so it has to happen where we live. We're identified with our bodies. That's what it is to have an ego. If you have no ego, you're transcendent. You don't have the karma either. No, that what you're talking about, a great soul can use his physical body to direct the energy of other people's karma through. And how that is done is, Master calls it a subtle yogic, an advanced yoga technique. And you know, I just wrote a letter on this point. In Autobiography of a Yogi, when Master talks about other people taking karma for other people, he talks about Sri Yukteswar having a high fever in Kashmir, which was a great blessing to his disciples because he took a lot of karma for his disciples. He talks about Sri Yukteswar doing that. He talks about spiritual supermen doing that. He talks about advanced yogis doing that. He talks about Christian saints doing that. And he talks about Therese Nuiman doing that. He doesn't talk about you or me doing that. It's something that's very subtle to be able. And in fact, one of the remarks of Durga Mata on this tape was, interestingly, this is the story that this woman told. She said a friend of hers was suffering something in their elbow. And this devotee thought, maybe I could take that karma for this person. And what happened was that she, the devotee, became so ill, almost unto death. And when she finally came out of the hospital, Durgamata sternly scolded her for the presumption of doing that. She said, "You can hardly carry your own karma. Don't think about taking anybody else's." Which is a strange comment, you know. I mean, the fact that even just having that thought drew to her all of that experience. So when a master does that, they have a power. They also know whether they ought to or not. And we don't have any idea when you take someone's karma, where did it start, where is it going, what are the implications of that? We haven't any idea what we're talking about. And to assume that we could lay all that pattern over the pattern we already have and not just break in half by it, you know, you really have to see. That's why we can't do it. And that's why Master doesn't exhort us to do it. You know, he exhorts us to do all kinds of things, but not that one. He describes that other great souls can do it. But even Swami Kriyananda won't say he's doing it. And this woman here said that Durgamata would never say she was doing it. She said, it's not, the way Swami put it to me, he said, I offer to Master to help people in any way I can, but it's not for me to say, he said, that I'm actually taking people's karma. It's just not for me to say. It's not appropriate. He said, it's up to God. You know, it's a very sacred and refined, and, you know, it's not something to mess around with. So, I mean, we can offer to help people. We can help people spiritually, but that's very specific things, you know. And in the meantime, the energy goes somewhere. I don't understand how it works, but the energy has to go somewhere. What Master describes is, in special cases, very advanced yogis can use their bodies to take the karma of others. In special cases, very advanced yogis can use their bodies. So things will happen to their bodies that are not the result of their own learning experience. But for us, it always is. And it's a way to learn. You know, here we are living in it. God has to get our attention somehow. Whack. That's a good way to get it. Because we notice. Does that make sense? All right, great souls, enough for tonight. See you next week.